The first hour, we completed the discussion on the two historical temples, and there are two more temples yet to come, and these are the prophetic temples. And now we move on to the third temple, also called the Tribulation Temple. What's the next slide? Now, we look at this passage yesterday, but let's go ahead and look at it again, Daniel chapter 9. But before that, let's deal with the first one in your outline. Let's go to Isaiah chapter 66, and then we'll go to Daniel 9. Isaiah chapter 66. Of these four temples, the first and second temple was sanctioned by God, and the fourth temple will be sanctioned by God because he himself will build that one. But the third temple is the one temple he does not sanction. You see this in Isaiah chapter 66, and Isaiah made this statement during the time when the Solomonic temple was still standing. Verse 1, thus says Jehovah, heaven is my throne and the earth is my footstool. What manner of house will you build unto me? What place shall be my rest? For all these things have my hand made, and so all these things came to be, says Jehovah. But to this man will I look, even to him that is of poor and of a contrite heart. And he that trembles at my word, he that kills an ox is as he that would slay a man, and he that sacrifices a lamb as breaking a dog's neck. He that offers an oblation is as he that offers swine's blood, and he that burns frankincense as he that blesses an idol. Yea, they have chosen their own ways, and their soul delights in their abominations. I will also choose their delusions and will bring their fears upon them, because when I called, none did answer. When I spoke, they did not hear, but they did that which was evil in mine eyes and chose wherein I delighted not. Hear the word of Jehovah, ye that tremble at his word, your brethren that hate you, that cast you out of for my name's sake, have said, let Jehovah be glorified that we may see your joy. But it is they that shall be put to shame. A voice of the tumult from a city, a voice from the temple, a voice of Jehovah that renders recompense to his enemies. If the Jews are seen prophetically of building the third temple, we see the protest of God, because he points out that there'll be no sanctifying of this temple, there'll be no Shekinah glory to this temple. Because by this point of time, with the second temple already gone, as well as the first, and the Messianic age of the Christian church age, Messianic age in that sense, has come in, really requires is faith, according to verse 2. In verse 3, no sacrifice will be acceptable, so offering a kosher animal would be just as wicked and evil as offering a non-kosher animal, like swine's blood. And no sacrifices will be acceptable. And in verse 4, when they're building this temple, they're still failing to listen to the voice of God. But in verse 5, there's encouragement to the believers who will not go along with this building of the third temple. And then verse 6, the temple only issue in judgment. So verses 1 through 6 describe a temple the Jews are building, but a temple that will not be sanctioned by God, because they're going back to the Mosaic system. And the Mosaic system ended when Messiah died, and there'll never be a resurrection of the Mosaic system. But let's go to the next passage on your outline, Daniel chapter 9. When we discussed the stages that lead up to the tribulation, the final stage chronologically will be the signing or sealing of the seven-year covenant. And verse 27, he shall make a firm covenant with many for 1 7. In the middle of the seven, he will cause the sacrifice, the oblation to cease. And upon the wing of abomination shall come one that makes desolate, and even unto the full end, and that determined shall wrath be put out upon the desolate. And what we see from this passage, that is dealing with the third temple, which by the midpoint of the tribulation is both standing and functioning. As we mentioned earlier, that gives us only two options as to when this temple will be rebuilt. It might be rebuilt during the first half of the tribulation, but also secondly, it might be rebuilt even before the tribulation starts. So timing-wise, we cannot make it more definite than that from what the scriptures at this point reveal. But we do know from this passage, by the middle of the tribulation, the temple is standing and the temple is functioning with a sacrificial system, which will be the Mosaic system. And then there will be a final cessation. And yes, the final cessation is referred to as the abomination of desolation. As we're about to see, the Antichrist will take over the city and the temple, and he'll declare himself to be God Almighty. Now, how long will the abomination continue? Let's go to chapter 12 and look at verse 11. Daniel chapter 12. And from the verse 11, and from the time that the continual burnt offering shall be taken away, and the abomination that makes desolate set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Now the second half of the tribulation is going to be exactly 1,260 days. But this abomination will be allowed to continue for an extra 30 days beyond the end of the tribulation, for a total of 1,290 days. Now, Daniel 9:27 didn't spell out exactly what the abomination is, but the most frequent use, not in all cases, but the most frequent use of the term abomination is something relative to idolatry. In this passage, it doesn't tell us much about the abomination, except it is something that is set up or something that is erected, as would be true with an image being erected. Now we'll go to Matthew chapter 24. In verse 15, Jesus gives a warning sign to the Jews living in the land. When this event occurs, this is verse 15, when therefore you see the abomination of desolation, which one? The one which was spoken of to Daniel the prophet, which he spoke about in Daniel 9:27 and chapter 12, verse 11, standing in the holy place, something that is standing in the holy place. Linda reads, understand, then let them in Judea flee unto the mountains. And what we learn from this passage is that the abomination of desolation will serve as a sign to the Jews living in the land. It could very well be to Jews elsewhere. That this is the one that they signed the covenant with. This is the one that they believed will keep them from any further military problems. This is the one that now turns against them, where he's taken over the Jewish temple and commits the abomination of desolation. Doesn't tell us what the abomination is just yet, but it tells us it becomes a sign to the Jews to flee the land. The Jewish state that began in 1948 will safely continue until the middle of the tribulation, then there'll be a collapse. And the Jews are told in this context, all the way down to verse 28, to flee the land. And there'll be another flight from the land. because the abomination of desolation signals Satan's final attempt to annihilate the Jews once and for all. He'll inaugurate a worldwide Nazi-like effort to try to annihilate every Jew living at this point of time. And therefore, they're told to flee. Now we'll go to Revelation 11. In verse 1, there was given me a reed like unto a rod, and one said, Rise and measure the temple of God and the altar and them that worship therein. And the court which is outside the temple, leave it out and measure it not. For it has been given unto the Gentiles, and the holy city shall they tread underfoot 42 months. This describes a Gentile takeover of the temple compound area that will occur at the midpoint of the tribulation and will continue for 42 months, which is equivalent to 3.5 years. So it will be equal to the second half of the tribulation. The second half of the tribulation, where the Jews will be fleeing the land. Doesn't specifically say what the abomination is. That brings us to point 2 of your outline. Let's go to the next slide. Next slide.
Sorry, it's playing up.
I don't mean for the slide to hold for 3.5 years. That was just how long the abomination would be. Now, what this shows as far as relevance to Bible prophecy is that these prophecies just read could not have been fulfilled in 1948 because the city of Jerusalem was split in two. The Jews was able to hang on to the west side, which was the new city, but the biblical Jerusalem, which was the old city, the temple compound, was taken over by the Jordanian legion, and they had sovereignty over it for 19 years until 1967. Only after the Six-Day War, when Israel captured the biblical Jerusalem, was it even possible for the temple to be rebuilt. So these prophecies could not have been fulfilled before 1967, but it became possible to be fulfilled only as of 1967. Next. So I'll come back to this slide a bit later. Now, what the abomination is involves two separate stages, and I'll turn now to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Look at verse 3, 2 Thess 2, verse 3. Let no man beguile you in any wise, for it will not be except the falling away come first, and the man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. He who opposes and exalts himself against all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits in the temple of God, setting himself forth as God. The first stage of the abomination is when the Antichrist and his army takes over the city and the temple. He will seat himself in the temple and proclaim himself to be God Almighty. And now there'll be a call to all people to worship him as God, but the call goes out only to the world Gentile population. The Jews won't have the option because the abomination for the Gentiles is a time where they have to make a decision to worship him or not worship him. But for the Jews, it's a sign of Jewish annihilationism. And therefore the Jews flee. Of other prophecies we know, like Jeremiah 50, 51, Isaiah 13 and 14, he will not remain in Jerusalem. What he will do is set up his political and economic capital in the rebuilt city of Babylon. Babylon, by the way, was largely rebuilt under Saddam Hussein before he was removed by President Bush. You might say he was bushwhacked. And so on. And in the two Gulf Wars, the city had not been affected. And ultimately, that is the city that is going to be both the political and economic capital of the world. And that's described, for example, in chapter 18 of Revelation. However, he will maintain Jerusalem as his religious capital and inaugurate the second stage. And for that, we go back to Revelation, this time chapter 13. Now, chapters 12 and 13 provide us information about the development of the counterfeit Trinity. Satan played the role of the counterfeit father, and that's his role in chapter 12. The Antichrist who played the role of the counterfeit son in chapter 13, verses 1 through 10, and the false prophet will play the role of the counterfeit Holy Spirit in verses 11 through 18. And so what Paul prophesied in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 is now given further elaboration in chapter 13, verses 1 through 10. We have a self-declaration of deity. But focus now in dealing with the third temple will be in verses 11 through 17. Verse 11, I saw another beast coming up out of the earth. He had two horns like unto a lamb, and he spoke as a dragon. So this is another beast, distinct from the first one of chapter 13, verses 1 through 10. And this one is compared to a lamb, which gives him a religious character. But he spoke as a dragon. The dragon was identified as Satan back in chapter 12. So he appears to be religious, was really of satanic origin. Verse 12, and he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his sight. And just as the true spirit is co-equal with the true son, here we see the counterfeit spirit is carrying out the counterfeit system. Is going to be co-equal with the counterfeit son. And he exercises all the authority of the first beast inside and makes the earth and them that dwell therein to worship the first beast whose death stroke was healed. And just as the spirit, the true spirit, draws people to worship the true son, here we see in the counterfeit system, the counterfeit spirit drawing people to worship the counterfeit son. So verse 13, and he does great signs that he should even make fire to come down out of heaven upon the earth in the sight of men. And just as the true spirit came with his miracles, signs, and wonders, the rising of the counterfeit spirit also accompanied by miracles, signs, and wonders, but these are of the satanic element. 14, and he deceives them that dwell in the earth by reason of the signs which is given him to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image of the beast whose death stroke was, whose stroke of the sword and lived. It was given unto him to give breath to it and even the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause them as many that should not worship the image of the beast should be killed. As part of the signs and wonders, he arranges to make an image of the counterfeit son. And then he gives life to this image. And this image has the capacity to speak, and has the capacity even to execute. And this is the image that will be erected into the third temple, already mentioned by Daniel in both prophecies, but especially chapter 12, verse 11, and also by Paul in 2 Thess 2, verses 3 and 4. And this is the image that will be in the temple for 1,290 days before it is eliminated. And so Jerusalem will maintain as the religious capital of the Antichrist. It is an image of him that people will now begin to worship worldwide. Now the true spirit came, he became the seal that seals us in the bar, the Messiah, and he came with his own seal that keeps us saved, and we cannot fall out of the body. But now notice the counterfeit seal. Verse 16, he causes all the small and the poor, the small and the great, and the rich and the poor, and the free and the bond, that it be given to them a mark on their right hand or upon their forehead, that no man should be able to buy or sell, save he that had the mark even on the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. He that had understanding, let him count the number of the beast. For it is the number of a man, and the number is 666. Now, he points out that those who are willing to accept the Antichrist as God should show it in a visible way. And the visible way is to take the mark of 666. They have the option to put it on the right hand. For the most zealous worshippers, they'll put it on the forehead, more easily seen. But that will be the mark of the beast. But in verse 17 and in verse 18, he gives five clues about the meaning of the mark. Now, this will not be a monetary system. It will not be a credit card system. It will not be a banking system. Because in that kind of a system, everybody has to have a different number. Now, if you have a Visa card, I have a Visa card, your number will be different than my number. But in this case, everybody receives the same number. And it doesn't say only the first three numbers will be the same, everything will be different as people then add to the text. It's not there. Everybody who worships the Antichrist will take the same number. And from the clues we have at the end of chapter verse 17 and verse 18, number one, it is the name of the beast. Secondly, the number of his name. Thirdly, It is the number of the beast, is the number of a man, and the number 666. What all these clues mean is simply this. In classical Hebrew, we didn't have a separate system of numbers and letters. So every letter was also a number. So every letter in the Hebrew alphabet has numerical value. And every word spelled with Hebrew characters has numerical value. And every name spelled out in Hebrew characters will have a numerical value. And the point is, the numerical value of the Antichrist name will be 666. So everyone who's ever taken even just Hebrew 101 can determine what the numerical value of a Hebrew letter, a Hebrew number, or a Hebrew name, what the numerical value is. And I can take anybody's name right here. If you give me your name, I can write it out in Hebrew and give you the numerical value of your name. If you want to see if you're a possible candidate for this office, I'll be able to determine that once I have your full name and put in the Hebrew letters. So that can be done during the lunch hour break, if you like, or at the end of the afternoon. But that is the significance of 666, and just keep it simple. And it's not a monetary system, banking system, credit card system. It is the numerical value of his name. There's no way to be able to determine up front, because it can have various different combinations. For example, the letters could be in the order of the numbers would be 4 and 6. It could also be 6 and 4. And if you triple it to three letters, it has multiple possibilities of how the name could be spelled, and therefore equals 666. So this is not something that can be predetermined in advance. It is something that can be only known once a person appears on the horizon that has some of the attributes and the low set numerical value of that specific name. And no, Donald Trump does not equal 666. And so this is the activities of the third temple, the Tribulation Temple. And ultimately, it will be destroyed. Now look at Zechariah chapter 14. Zechariah chapter 14. Concluding the campaign of Armageddon in chapter 14, verse 3, the Messiah will then ascend up to the Mount of Olives, and that'll be followed by a tremendous earthquake. And verse 4 describes, and his feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives shall be cleft in the midst thereof towards the east and towards the west, and there shall be a very great valley. Half of the mountain shall remove toward the north, and half of it toward the south, and ye shall flee by the valley of my mountains. For the valley of the mountain shall reach unto Azel, yea, ye shall flee like a fled from before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. And Jehovah my God shall come with all the holy ones with you. And so there'll be a massive destruction of what's left of Jerusalem following the events of the second coming. And this would include the destruction of the Tribulation Temple. And that's when the removal will come for the image that will be there for 1,290 days, according to Daniel chapter 12 and verse 11. And that will be a cessation of the Tribulation Temple. Okay, let's go down to some of the things the Temple Institute. The Temple Institute has been now for years building and putting together all of the necessary clothing and furnishings which is going to be necessary for the Tribulation Temple. And last time I was there, which was last year, they have pretty well completed everything they need. They've got the clothing for the common priest, they have the clothing for the high priest, they have the lots for the scapegoat choosing. They also have all the pots and pans for the various blood oblations and wine oblations. They've got the silver trumpets. They got the golden lampstand. They've got the table of showbread. It's now pretty well all there. So once the temple is built, they can take the things right into a new temple. And although there have been periodically rumors breaking out, the Jews have started to rebuild the temple. None of those rumors are true at this stage. I returned from Israel, finishing my studies 2 months after the Six-Day War. I didn't hear anything about this in Israel, but when I came back to America, I heard all of these rumors in different churches that Jews have begun importing stones from Bedford, Indiana, to rebuild the temple. I knew there was something wrong about that rumor, but I kept hearing it. If you've ever been to Israel, some of you have, you don't, after a couple of days, here's what you find out. The last thing Israel needs to import from anywhere is stones and rocks. That's the last thing Israel needs to import. Furthermore, according to the Jewish law, the stones for the temple must come out of the limestone that make up the hill country of Judah, just like they saw the previous temples. And so they don't need to bring the stones from Bedford, Indiana. There is a story in the Talmud that explains why there's so much rock in Israel. God created all the rocks at the same point of time. He put them in two big bags. He gave each big bag to a specific angel. Angel was told to go out and evenly spread the rocks around the world. And the first angel did that. When the second angel began to fly, he flew over Israel, and the bag ripped, and half the world's rocks fell into Israel. And that's why there is so much rock and stone in the land of Israel. But there's no need for the when they're ready, they'll easily find the stones quite locally and not having to go all the way to Indiana, USA. But the actual building is not yet got started. Now, question that comes up is the Ark of the Covenant. There's an assumption among many believers that they have to find the ark because before the temple could function, and that's not correct. In fact, the second temple functioned for 6 centuries with no Ark of the Covenant, and so on. And God accepted the blood sacrifices apart from having the Ark of the Covenant. And when we get to the fourth temple, we'll realize from a prophecy that Ezekiel gave, the fourth temple, the temple of the millennium, is not going to have the Ark of the Covenant either. So there are certain Christian groups out looking for the Ark of the Covenant. 3 different groups have claimed to have found it. 1 group found it in Ethiopia. 1 group found it on the east side of the Jordan, a modern-day country of the Jordan. And 1 group found it in what's called Zedekiah's Cave, which is right across the street from the north wall of Jerusalem. And none of them ever produced any pictures of what they found. For some reason, they have the same excuse. For some reason, the camera wouldn't work. For some reason or another. So these are all false rumors. And the Ark of the Covenant probably did not survive the Babylonian destruction, because it lists all the things that Nebuchadnezzar took with him. It does not list the Ark of the Covenant. And keep in mind, the Ark of the Covenant from a Babylonian perspective was just a box of wood overlaid with gold. They would strip the gold and burn the wood. And so they couldn't find the Ark 7 years later when the second temple was built. They won't find this one now that 2,500 years have passed since the Ark was last seen. So the Ark is not necessary to find it or build a new one. Okay, let's go to the other one. The Jeremiah 52 passage, by the way, lists all the stuff Nebuchadnezzar took. It doesn't list the Ark of the Covenant. Now, the other issue is the issue of the red heifer. Now, the laws of the red heifer are found in the book of Numbers, chapter 19, Numbers 19. And the Mosaic law, it was to be primarily a reddish-brown cow. And it had to be 3 years old. But rabbinic law made it more stringent than what's the law of today in the land of Israel, in that it cannot have more than 2 white hairs, or cannot have more than 2 black hairs, or any mixture of those. And thus far, they've been unable to produce such a perfect red heifer. Now, years ago, it's been at least 2 decades ago, there was an announcement that they have a perfect red heifer, but because the red heifer doesn't get slaughtered until the age of 3. But at that point of time, it had about 10 different black-white hairs and was disqualified. And they haven't found a close one as yet, as far as we know. Now, when that red heifer was disqualified, the red heifer, by the way, is not a sacrifice. It was not killed at the temple compound. It was taken to the Mount of Olives, killed, burned to ashes. And the purpose of it was called corpse uncleanness. Anyone who touches a dead corpse is unclean for 7 days and must undergo a 7-day cleansing. And during those 7 days of cleansing, twice, he's sprinkled with water mixed with the ashes of the red heifer to cleanse his uncleanness. So that was what was used for him. Before any priest could function in the new temple, he has to undergo the cleansing of the waters of the red heifer. So what happened was, when a Texan rancher found out about their lack of having red heifer, he had several perfect red heifers that he raised in Texas, and he shipped them to Israel, and you would think that would solve the problem, except for one other rabbinic contingency. for the red heifer to be kosher, to be the red heifer offering or sacrifice, it must be born in Israel. It cannot be born in Texas. It has to be a Jewish cow. It cannot be a Gentile cow. I guess that means it must be a Holstein, not an Angus. But what they've taken is these red heifer that was sent, and they're using genetic engineering to try to produce the perfect red heifer. No announcement that they've been successful. As of a newspaper article in the Jerusalem Post about 3-4 months ago, they still didn't have one, but this is still what they're trying to do. Ultimately, they'll probably end up producing it because the Bible clearly teaches the existence of the third temple. So that's another thing going on at the present time. Next. Okay, that's as far as the slides go. So that's as far as we can talk about insofar as the third temple. Okay, let's now move on to the third temple, and the fourth temple. And most of the details are found in Ezekiel chapter 40, verse 5, to chapter 43, verse 27. However, there's already other references to this. So let's begin with Isaiah chapter 2. Isaiah chapter 2. Isaiah chapter 2, verse 2. It shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of Jehovah's house shall be established on top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills. All nations will flow into it. So he describes a mountain, which we'll get more details from Ezekiel in a few moments, which will be the highest mountain in the world. It'll be rising within the borders of the land of Israel. And it shall be the place where many groups are going to be attracted for pilgrimage purposes. So verse 3, and many people shall go and say, come ye, let us go unto the mountain of Jehovah, to the house of the God of Jacob. So we know now that the middle temple be on top of this highest mountain in the world. And he will teach us of his ways, and we shall walk in his paths. For Zion shall go forth the law and the word of Jehovah from Jerusalem. And he will install there'll be a new body of law, which we can call kingdom law. There'll be the rule of life for that day. It'll go forth from this mountain. And in verse 4, he will judge between the nations and will decide concerning many peoples, and they shall beat the swords into plowshares, the spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall lift up the sword no more against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. While there be differences still arising among nations, these differences will not be settled by war, but by arbitration from the King of the world, the Messiah, which will be from Jerusalem, which will be on this very high mountain, which will come as a result of the tremendous earthquake at the time of him standing upon the Mount of Olives. Now go to Isaiah 27. A passage you already read a couple of times yesterday. But the key thing to note is the last phrase of verse 13. And they shall worship Jehovah in the holy mountain at Jerusalem. And so the holy mountain, the new mountain already described back in chapter 2, will be where the temple will be, where Jerusalem will be. And it's going to be the place where they'll gather together for the purpose of worshiping God in that future time. Now go to chapter 56. Isaiah 56, verse 6. Also the foreigners that join themselves to Jehovah, to minister unto him, and to love the name of Jehovah, to be his servants, everyone that keeps the Sabbath and from profaning it and holding fast my covenant, even them will I bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and the sacrifices shall be accepted upon mine altar, for my house shall be called a house of prayer for all peoples. And the Lord Jehovah, who gathered the outcasts of Israel, says, yet will I gather others to him besides his own that are gathered. Here he brings in the Gentile element of the future. Under the Mosaic law, the function of the tabernacle temple was intended to be for Jews only, and Gentiles were limited to the court of the Gentiles. But that won't be true for the fourth temple. It'll be a time that both Jews and Gentiles can come to pray, and it'll be a time that the Sabbath will again be part of the rule of life under kingdom law in the future. And then he'll bring them, verse 7, to my holy mountain, the same holy mountain as chapter 2. There will be the house of prayer, but not limited for Jews or full proselytes, but will be available to all peoples who have joined themselves to the God of Israel. And now go to chapter 66. Look at verse 20, 66 verse 20. And they shall bring all your brethren out of all the nations for an oblation unto Jehovah upon horses and in chariots and litters and upon mules and upon dromedaries to my holy mountain Jerusalem, says Jehovah, as the children of Israel bring their oblation to a clean vessel into the house of Jehovah, and of them also I take for priests and for Levites, says Jehovah. Notice two things here. That the Jews will come for the purpose of worshiping at this holy mountain, but not only will there be Jewish priests from the Levitical tribe, he points out even among the Gentiles, he'll choose some for priests and Levites. So some will be like Levites, they'll be part of the caretaking bodies of the temple compound in the future, but also as priests who'll be part of people in charge of the sacrifices of the Messianic kingdom and the Messianic temple. One more passage before we go to Ezekiel, turn to Micah chapter 4. Now, Micah chapter 4, verses 1 through 4, is actually a quotation of Isaiah chapter 2, verses 2 through 4, which we already read, so I won't reread it. But Micah then adds another small detail, which is in chapter 4, verse 4. But they shall sit, every man under his vine, under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid, for the mouth of Jehovah host has spoken it. And the phrase, under every man that's vine under fig tree, is an idiom used frequently in the Hebrew Bible of a time of peace and prosperity. A time of peace and prosperity. Now, what we should note from all this, Ezekiel is not the only prophet that speaks of the future temple. He's the one that gives us the most details. But even before Ezekiel, it was already prophesied by Isaiah and by Micah more than two centuries earlier. So with this in mind, let's go to Ezekiel chapter 40. Look at verse 1. In the 25th year of our captivity, in the beginning of the year, in the 10th day of the month, in the 14th year after that city was smitten, in the selfsame day, the hand of Jehovah was upon me, and he brought me thither. In the visions of God brought he me into the land of Israel, and set me down upon a very high mountain, whereunto was, as it were, the frame of a city on the north, on the south. And what he sees is a huge mountain, the same mountain spoken of by Micah and by Isaiah, rising very high to become the top of the mountains and top of the hills. But he, as Ziegler points out, there is the skyline of a city at the south end of the mountain, because that's where the millennial Jerusalem will be, on the south end of this mountain. That's not where the temple will be. So it begins with the mountain of Jehovah's house. He goes on to provide the details of this millennial temple. And the details begin in chapter 40, verse 3, and goes to chapter 44, verse 8. Chapter 40, verse 3, to chapter 44, verse 8. We'll come back to that momentarily. Now, chapter 44, verses 9 through 31, chapter 44, verses 9 through 31, describe the law of the priests. Chapter 45, verses 1 through 8, 45 verses 1 through 8, describes the holy mountain with some more detail. Chapter 45, verse 9 to chapter 46, verse 24, describes the law of the sacrifices, and not necessarily everything in the Mosaic law will be also inaugurated, but there will be Sabbath day sacrifices, which is a weekly thing. There'll be the new moon sacrifices, which is a monthly thing. And among the seven holy seasons, the Feast of Passover and the Feast of Tabernacles will be what will be observed. There's no mention of the other festivities, but the Passover and the Feast of Tabernacles. And the Feast of Passover, uniquely for the Jewish people, but the Feast of Tabernacles initially was meant for the Jewish people, but now also extended to the Gentiles. So in Zechariah 14, verses 16 through 19, Zechariah 14, verses 16 through 19, points out that every Gentile nation in the kingdom would be obligated to send a delegation to worship God in Jerusalem. And furthermore, they'll be disciplined if they fail to do so, and they'll be disciplined by a lack of rain or a drought. So use the example of Egypt. If Egypt chooses not to send delegation to Jerusalem, upon them there shall be no rain. But why pick on Egypt? If there will be a nation reluctant to observe the Feast of Tabernacles, it would be Egypt. The Feast of Tabernacles arose out of the failure of Egypt to keep the Jews from escaping. And maybe one day the leadership of Egypt will say, why are we sending delegation to Jerusalem to observe our Egyptian failure? What nation celebrates the failure? And perhaps they will choose one year not to send delegation, but after suffering a drought for that year, they won't make the same mistake a second time. Because not to say that would be true for all the nations. This is Zechariah 14, verses 16 to 19. In chapter 47, verses 1 through 12, will be the Millennial River. We'll say about that more in just a few moments. And then he'll describe the tribal divisions from chapter 47, verse 13, through chapter 48, verse 29. And finally, the Millennial Jerusalem in chapter 48, verses 30 to 35. Chapter 48, verses 30 to 35. The one thing we know that will be missing will be the Ark of the Covenant. And just turn, you can keep your finger in Ezekiel, but turn to Jeremiah chapter 3. Jeremiah chapter 3. The context begins in verse 11, goes down to verse 18, describing Israel in the Messianic Kingdom. But look at verse 16. Verse 16, shall come to pass when ye are multiplied, increased into the land. In those days, says Jehovah, they shall say no more, the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah. Neither shall it come to mind, neither shall they remember it, neither shall they miss it, neither shall it be made anymore. So it'll be totally out of mind at that point of time. There will not be an Ark of the Covenant in the Millennial Temple. Now go to the next page and look at some of these charts you have. What you have in the first chart is a map, so to speak. And first of all, you'll see the millennial Israel along the black lines and how far north, that, which is well into Lebanon, will be the northern border. At the east side, that's as far as the line will go. It may not quite go that far, but that's as far as it could go based upon the geography that they were given. It'll come to the Jordan River as it exits the Sea of Galilee, and then the Jordan River is the eastern border along with the Dead Sea. As it moves to the west, it will take in certain segments of the Negev, going down to what is now the Wadi El Arish, that was the brook of Egypt in ancient times. And it will, and the western border obviously would be the Mediterranean Sea. And the way God will settle the tribes, notice in the middle of the country you have the square that is then enlarged on the side, but look at the middle square on the map first. And God will settle the seven of the 12 tribes going north to south. They'll simply be in parallel lines. And the order will be Dan, Asher, Naphtali, Manasseh, Ephraim, Reuben, and Judah. And then this new mountain. And in the south end of the mountain will be the tribes of Benjamin, Simeon, Issachar, Zebulun, and Gad. This is not the same localities that we find in the book of Joshua. Furthermore, this is the first time the Jews will have all of the promised land, and so the 12 tribes will be settled in all the promised land. As I mentioned, for years I did the special 5-week-long study tours of Israel. I'm not doing them anymore, but when the kingdom is established, because there'll be so much more, I will reinaugurate and it'll be a 10-week trip to Israel, so I can cover the whole new country. And I'm taking reservations now with a down payment, so you can make sure you get your seat in that future tour. But let's look at the mountain. You have a large part on the lower right-hand side. And this mountain will have essentially a 50-mile or 80-kilometer flat plateau. And on the northern end will be the Millennial Temple. And it'll be the biggest temple in Israel's history. In fact, the measurement for the temple compound will be about a mile square. The modern-day temple compound, even with the enlargement made by Herod the Great, is still only a quarter mile square. So this temple describes one fit in the modern Temple Mount. And the rest of the area will be for the priests to live in, and among the Jewish priests will be those who are direct descendants of Zadok. Zadok was the loyal priest to David and Solomon, and therefore God honored him that it is his descendants that will function as priests during the Millennial Kingdom. Now all the other Levites who are not of the priesthood will live in the center section. Northern section will be 20 miles by 50 miles, central section 20 miles by 50 miles. At the south end, around the center, measuring 10 miles by 10 miles, will be the Millennial Jerusalem. There'll be a new name given to it. In Hebrew, Adonai Shammah, or Yahweh Shammah, meaning Jehovah is there, because the Messiah will reign from their city. So you should notice the Millennial Temple will not be within the confines of Jerusalem, but outside the confines. And on both sides of Jerusalem, measuring 20 by 10 miles, is going to be the place for food growing for the residents in Jerusalem. Now go to your next page. So this gives you a more detailed picture of the temple compound on the north end of the mountain. The additions we put here is that there's going to be the Millennial River I mentioned in passing a few moments ago. There's going to be a river that will flow from the threshold of the Millennial Temple. It will flow eastward. It will then turn south and go through the tribal Levi territory and come into Jerusalem. But then it will divide into two directions. And the rivers going to the west will empty into the Mediterranean, and the river going to the east will empty into the Dead Sea. And that provides the water necessary for the food growing for the residents in Jerusalem. And it will change the nature of the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea is called the Dead Sea because it is so rich in minerals, so thick, the fish cannot survive in it. So you find pictures sometimes of fish coming down the Jordan River, entering the Dead Sea, and they quickly make a U-turn, heading back against the flow of the river, trying to escape entering the Dead Sea because they won't survive it. But if you're afraid you're going to miss your Dead Sea float, I got good news for you. It says the south end of the Dead Sea will still be given over to salt. So the top of two-thirds will become a major fishing industry during the Messianic Kingdom. But the south end is going to be given over to salt. You just have to go to the south end to do your Dead Sea float, and not where people go today, which is Ein Gedi, because Ein Gedi will be part of the area which will be a fishing business. Now notice the chambers. There are 20 chambers right on the border between the northern aspect and the central aspect. Now Levites are going to be in charge of caretakers of the temple, but so they do not live in the temple compound. But the Levites assigned to be caretakers for a specific period of time will live in these 20 chambers. They will commute to work in the morning, come back at night until the time is over. Then they'll go back to the Levitical section, to their homes, and others will take their place. So these rooms are going to be for housing for Levites for the period of time that they'll be caretaking for the temple. Now the next page. Here you see the temple compound. Notice there's going to be an outer wall, and then interior wall, with gates on the north, east, and south, but not on the west. And all those numbers you see here. Well, they skipped that page, but there was an additional page that should have been there that gives you what those numbers represent. But you'll find this in the Footsteps of the Messiah, if you can check it out in there. And you see how the temple will be, and so on. Now the next and last page, is the temple building itself. The temple building itself with an outer inner wall with chambers in between the two walls. And certain segments are the same, but certain segments are different, but that gives you a basic idea of how these things will be. Now, this will be the system that will last for 1,000 years. But we'll come to an end, because only 1,000 years do we enter the forever state. So turn to Revelation chapter 20. Well, in the tribulation, there'll be one last revolt against God's authority. The revolt will attempt to invade Israel, but when they arrive on the shores of Israel, God will dispense with them with fire out of heaven. And then the other two members, or the other member of the Counterfeit Trinity, will join the other two members into a lake of fire. And then verses 11 through 15, you have the account of the all unbelievers being judged and cast into lake of fire. But look at chapter 20, verse 11. I saw a great white throne, and him that sat upon it, from whose face the earth and heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. So all of that we have in the universe since Genesis chapter 1 will just suddenly disappear. And that's repeated in chapter 21 and verse 1. I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth passed away, and the sea is no more. What we shall see is a return to the pre-satanic fall state. We find a description of the earth before Satan's fall in Ezekiel 28, verses 11 through 19. Ezekiel 28, 11 through 19, it describes the earth as a beautiful mineral garden, totally covered by precious stones that exuded light and therefore called the stones of fire. And Satan was given authority before his fall over that earth, which was a different kind of earth. But in the biblical principle, you see frequently when God judges someone in authority, he also judges that which is under that person's authority. And so when God judged Satan, he also judged what was under Satan's authority, which was the earth. And so the earth, once a beautiful mineral garden with precious stones exuding light, now became totally covered by the salt waters of the Red Sea, and there was now darkness upon the face of the deep. And that was the result of Satan's fall. Now, with the 6 days of creation, it actually begins in verse 3. God begins to fashion the earth anew for a new race of beings, humanity. So some of the effects of Satan's fall is removed and dry land appears, but most of the earth is still covered by salt water. The new earth is created. Notice the sea is no more, no more salt water. Now all of the effects of Satan's fall are permanently removed. And then as he describes the New Jerusalem of that day, which goes beyond our purpose here, he points out that in place of 10 precious stones, there'll be 12 different precious stones making up the foundation of the New Jerusalem. But the main thing to notice is chapter 21 and verse 22. Chapter 21 and verse 22. It says, I saw no temple therein. The Lord God, the Almighty, and the Lamb are the temple thereof. And so the millennial temple will also cease to exist when this earth ceases to exist. And for the eternal order, the temple will be no more. And we shall enjoy an eternity. Will be of a different nature than what we enjoy now or what we will enjoy in the Messianic Kingdom. Okay, that concludes our study. Let me see what questions we have. I have, anybody have any?
This afternoon.
Oh, I'm sorry, that's right.